and the conference. And I also realized that being the last speaker of the day, your thoughts are probably turning to dinner at this point. So I've put together a menu to hopefully direct your thoughts. All right, so I'm going to talk about contextuality today. By the way, does this sound all right? It sounds like a very hollow echo from my point of view. It's a little too loud? Okay. All right. That's better. All right. So I want to start off by talking about contextuality, what's meant by this, and use a particular example, which is often referred to as the Mermin-Perez or magic square, which I have written on the board over here for reference. Go into a main course talking about functional composition principle and how this has a bearing on Cook and Specker theorem. And then for dessert, I'd like to discuss decomposability and some applications to recent experiments testing contextuality. All right, so appetizers. Okay, so what is contextuality? One way of viewing it is that you have a unique measurement for every hidden variable state, so it's deterministic. It should reproduce all the statistical predictions of quantum mechanics. It's a viable theory. But more importantly, there's this notion that the result of measurements should be independent of simultaneous or previously measured quantities. And so I've shown two little cartoon examples where this should be obviously true. You have a measurement of observable A, and if you make a measurement of compatible observables B, or B and A are compatible, A and C are compatible, it shouldn't make a lick of difference which one you choose at a later time on the bearing of what you measure at A. That's just causality. Similarly, if the measurement occurs in some space-like separated region, a la Bell's theorem, that should also not make a difference. All right, that's something you would expect of a realistic theory. However, let's consider a different situation, one in which you've measured either B or C prior to A. Okay, they're still compatible, but now the question is, could that possibly affect the actual outcome of the measurement of A? Certainly the statistical distributions aren't going to change, the joint distributions, but I would argue that the actual number that you get out could depend upon whether B or C happens to be chosen. In a similar way, if A and then B or C are all done simultaneously and co-located, which seems a bit pedantic, but it's actually relevant for the experiment I'm going to talk about. Again, you could expect that there would be a distinction, and so there could be a dependency. All right, so I want to introduce this as a way of sort of expanding the notion of what a reasonable contextual theory or non-contextual theory should be composed of. All right, so here's the Mermin-Perez magic square. I love the term magic square. It consists of nine operators, which are direct products of three different Pauli matrices. And the interesting properties of this is if you look on each of the rows, multiply everything together, you get plus one. If you do the same thing along the columns, you get plus one in the first two cases, but importantly, you get minus one in the very last case. The operators in each row commute with each other in each column, and they anti-commute with all of the other four. Okay. All right, so that's what we know from quantum mechanics. Now, the question is, suppose we want to define a deterministic theory, a hidden variable theory, of observations on the Mermin-Perez magic square. So we're contemplating a set of nine functions, measurable functions, on some hidden variable space, and I use omega instead of the more traditional lambda for my own first reasons. And so we're looking for a set of functions such that if omega is the, quote, true hidden variable state, then V of omega is the result of measuring it. And I put this in quotes because I will specify more clearly where it is here ambiguous and unclear what I mean by the true hidden variable state. But at any rate, here's a set of functions. And now let's define, motivated by the properties of the corresponding quantum operators, the following six sets. So these are subsets of the hidden variable space. And I've defined them such that for, say, R sub I from 1 to 3, it takes on a value of either minus 1 or plus 1. And its product is plus 1 for the three rows. So this is for each of the three rows. And then define the same thing for each of the columns, where very importantly, C3 is kind of the odd man out, where the product is minus 1. This is just a definition of subsets of the hidden variable space. It's not a property of anything. OK. All right. So here's the traditional argument for why you can't construct a set of functions like this. Let's suppose that there is a hidden variable that is common to all six sets. And then you find from the first property, the fact that it's in all of these three, you multiply along each of the rows, you get plus 1 for each of the rows, giving you a total of plus 1. And then similarly for the columns, which is minus 1. Of course, these two things have to be equal. They're just products of all nine quantities, each of which is represented twice. And so you arrive with a contradiction. OK, now, an important question is, what do you conclude from that contradiction? Well, obviously, you have to conclude that your assumption that there was a point common to all those sets is wrong. It's got to be empty. OK? All right, so is that a problem? Well, perhaps. Now, the way one normally goes about, if somewhat implicitly, arguing for the conclusion Koch-Specker theorem is that essentially all of those sets are equal to one another and equal to the entirety of the hidden variable space. You can make a somewhat less strong claim, but that's essentially what you're doing. And I have written here in quotes, since each set has probability 1. We know that if we measure the first row, the elements of the first row, we will always get plus 1 for that product. And so in some sense, it is probability 1. OK, so this is the argument. I'm trying to make it very explicit. I've written here this term funk, which is an abbreviation for the functional composition principle, which is a term that philosophers like, because philosophers seem to like Koch and Specter a lot more than physicists do. From this, we have to conclude that omega is the empty set, and so what you have is a vacuous set of functions, OK? That's the way the story normally goes. However, this assumption, I claim, is suspect. And if you relax this assumption, you actually can do quite a lot. OK, so on to the main course. All right, just a brief discussion of the relationship between probability theory and quantum mechanics. We've heard a few talks about this. All right, so this is entirely non-controversial. If you have a set of commuting operators and you have a quantum state, psi, then there's a probability space that's associated with that and a set of random variables, i.e. measurable functions on the hidden variable space, such that their joint distribution agrees with all the statistical predictions of quantum mechanics. There's nothing controversial about that until you start looking at different sets of commuting observables. Then things get kind of funny. All right, so what is this sample space omega? Well, if you're a statistician, you might think of this as just a set of outcomes. All right, and a lot of people will take the ontic states in a hidden variable theory to be just that. They're the things that you get out of measurement. But physicists tend to think in a richer domain. And so you might think of omega as something like a set of microstates in a sort of classical sense. It has a much richer structure to it, has a lot more things in it. And so in that case, these random variables really are maps from the microscopic states to some macroscopic description. Okay. So functional composition principle. Let me just lay this out to bear. All right, so the idea is you have a set of commuting observables here, and they satisfy some functional relationship. In our case, the product equals plus one or minus one. All right, now it follows that if you take our corresponding set of random variables that we just described in the previous slide, that they satisfy the same functional relationship, but here's the kicker, it's for p almost every omega, p almost every hidden variable. Okay, that may just seem pedantic. We're used to ignoring things that are, you know, just probability one. But here's the thing, right? The fact of the matter is that this p, this distribution, is going to depend not only on your quantum state psi, but in general on the set of commuting observables that you've chosen. That's what general theory tells us. Okay? It would be nice to say that a given quantum state gives rise to a particular probability measure, and the observables all correspond to measurable functions on that probability space, but that's not what quantum mechanics tells us, so I'm not going to impose that. Okay. So one can take actually two different views, and I'm going to spare you the details of how one goes about this, but I do have the details of this written up in a paper that is on the table over there. Feel free to avail yourself of it. Okay, you can take one view, which is there's one common probability space, and I've got 18 different random variables. Each one corresponds to conditioning on some context, so a particular row or a particular column. Okay, and so that's usually the way we tend to think of this. But here's another way of looking at it, which is mathematically equivalent. You can take a common probability space and six different probability measures corresponding to each of the rows and columns, and a set of nine measurable functions or random variables. Okay? Two different ways of looking at the same thing. In some ways, I find this to be a little bit more natural. And at any rate, this defines, this gives you a well-defined set of deterministic functions on that hidden variable space. So then the question becomes, what actually determines which probability measure you use? Why, you know, isn't that just another way of saying you've got the same problem in a different place? Okay, here's my view on things, and I think this has the ability to resolve or bring together a lot of different ideas. We think about the initial hidden variable state, some omega naught, right? Some definite state that the system is in initially. And we associate some probability measure along with that, which might represent our epistemic uncertainty regarding what this state of that really is, right? And or you could view that as corresponding to a particular preparation procedure that defines an ensemble. Okay, now we take that and we measure something on it. Now measuring something on it is not just a matter of, you know, lifting the veil and seeing what the value is. You have to interact with some device in order to do that. You do that classically, you have to do it quantum mechanically as well. In the process of measuring this thing, it's entirely conceivable, in fact, it's inconceivable that it wouldn't happen, that that state gets altered in some form or fashion. Okay. It gets altered by some deterministic process. So this is different from the Rob's toy model. There's a deterministic process that leads you to a new hidden variable state. Of course, the ensemble gets mapped accordingly. It's a new ensemble. You can think of this as a collapse of the wave function if you like. I wouldn't necessarily suggest that terminology. And then the actual measurement is the macroscopic quantity or the mapping from that final state. And then you get, you know, plus one or minus one, whatever. Okay. It's kind of cut off of that. That's the distribution of the macroscopic state. Had you chosen to measure a different thing, a different quantity. It's the same story, but of course you get a different quantity, different ensemble, and the result may or may not be the same. Okay, this is the physical picture that I'd like you to have in your mind, and my suggestion is that when we talk about the hidden variable state that we're trying to map a deterministic quantity onto, that it's really this final state, not the initial state. Okay, now let's think about this in terms of the sequence of measurements. So how does this work? I want to measure, say, the elements that are in row 3 of my magic square. Okay, so I start off and measure the one in the lower right-hand corner. All right, so I've got some initial state. It now maps deterministically to some new state, and I can read off what the macroscopic quantity, what the actual observable is, what the measurement outcome is. Same process for the next observable. Here I'm doing this in sequence. Okay, and the supposition here is that these are time-like separated measurements. Space-like separated, you get into locality, and I'm not addressing that issue here. Okay, and so forth. So through this process of sequentially measuring each of these observables, you get an outcome for each one, and the hidden variable state changes at each point. Okay, that's fine, but now there's some constraints that quantum mechanics is going to impose on us, which will question whether such a mapping actually exists. For one thing, I should have that no matter which state I was looking at, this one, or this one, the outcome that I got on that first measurement should be the same. The ordering isn't going to matter. And finally, I should have that when I take the product of all these things, I should get plus one for P naught almost every initial guy, right? So it's this one, or P sub row one almost every final guy. Okay? Now it's not at all obvious that a mapping like that exists. But it turns out you can construct one. It's a mathematical contrivance, but it gets the job done. And I give that explicitly in the paper. Okay, so now we have a mechanism for doing this. All right, so suppose that we had chosen to measure column 3 instead of row 3, right? We could have done that. I start off with the same initial state, and I initially do the same measurement, so I get some omega prime. And then, you know, had I chosen to measure the next thing in row 3, I would have gotten one state. If I instead chosen to measure something in the column, that puts me in a new state, and that determines where that final state lies. Is it going to be in the row R3 or C3? We know it can't be in all 6 sets at once, but it can certainly be in one of them, and it'll be in at least, and it could be in 5 of them. Okay, so it's really our choice of that second measurement that determines which measure is really appropriate, and whether the final state is contained in R3 or in C3. Okay, so to summarize here, we have an object view that's maintained by supposing that we have some hidden variable state, right? I'm assuming this is a thing that either exists or it's a characteristic of something that exists in the classical sense. There's an epistemic view that's maintained by supposing that you have some initial ensemble, and you can view that in whichever way you like to view prior probabilities. Okay, however, there's a few things that are a little different here. Measuring an observable may alter the underlying object state, okay? You can construe this as a deterministic process, at least in the example that I'm giving here. I can't make a more general statement. This can always be done, but I would hypothesize that it can be. The observed outcome is determined by the final object state, and I've already shown that for this example, whether you view that object state to be an intermediary or the final one, you get the same quantity. choice observables leads to different final ontic states. Okay? So this leads to the appearance of contextuality. But the contextuality arises from your choice of measurement in a deterministic manner. Nevertheless, quantum statistics, even joint statistics, are preserved. They have to be preserved in order for this to be a consistent theory. Okay? And I would like to think that this way of viewing things reconciles Einstein's notion of realism. You have ontic things, but they can change as a result of measurement. And yet it's also reflective of Bohr's view of relativism or of complementarity, in that what's actually being measured, that the ontic state depends upon what you actually measure, right? Okay, on to dessert. And this is probably a pun that's overused at the Perimeter Institute, I'm guessing, but blackberry pie seems to be the appropriate thing to eat around here. Thank you. Is that 5 from my 20? Yeah, okay. All right, so decomposability. When one normally talks about contextuality, this rather unfortunate notation often gets used. You talk about the value of a particular observable, which I'm referring to as just this function of the final state. Okay, so here's the idea. If you have two different observables and they commute, does the value that corresponds to that product equal the product of the values of those two things? Or in the notation that I'm using here, does the variable corresponding to the last element of that row correspond to the product of the values of the first two elements of that row? Well, there's a simple and unambiguous answer to that question. It's if and only if omega is in that set R1 by definition. Okay. So how you decompose things is going to depend upon the hidden variable state. And you can play lots of games with this. And if you're a mathematician, this can be fun. Suppose that you have an omega that's in these four different states all simultaneously. Okay. You can define certain quantities here. The first four you might think of as being, you know, x1, x2, y1, y2. And then from there, you can think about products, right? So this one could be thought of as a product of these two guys. We know that that's true in terms of the operators. Since we've made this assumption about the hidden variable state, it's also true here. Okay, so you can go along and look at all these different combinations. But then when you run into a problem here, what is this? Well, it's not clear. And it turns out it has two different decompositions, depending upon your assumptions of omega. If it also happens to be in R3, you get this quantity here with a plus sign. If it happens to be in C3, you get a minus sign. Okay, so decomposition depends upon what you're assuming about that final hidden variable state, which, as I've said before, is really determined by this deterministic measurement process. Okay, I'm going to try to go through this very quickly. This is an experiment that was conducted back in 2005, neutron interferometry. And the idea here is we're trying to take this four-dimensional Hilbert space and map it to a spin space and a path space for the interferometer. The experimenter set up the system so that it had this initial entangled state between spin and path. And what they're trying to do is measure quantities from the magic square on this system. So it was a nice analogy. Okay. In particular, they were looking at these three quantities here, which are the three quantities in the third column. And what they were looking at was this quantity here, which for this particular entangled state should have a value of 4, right, which you can convince yourself is true. And they were comparing this to quantity in terms of the non-contextual theory. This was my notation and not theirs, but amounts to the same thing. Looking at the expectation of the variables corresponding to those three quantities with respect to column 3 measures, since that's what's being measured. They claim that this quantity should be bounded by 2. What they get is a number that's about 3. So 3 is not 4, but it's an obvious violation. So the question is, what's going on? Okay. Basically, their derivation of that upper bound assumed a particular decomposition that allowed them to make this. What they've assumed is that that non-contextual expression, the integrand, basically has this form here. So there's this quantity here with this minus sign. And if you do that, you look at all the different combinations of what you can get, you'll get something that's either plus one or plus two or minus two. Okay. That holds if you assume that omega is in this particular set. If you make a different assumption, that it happens to be in this set, you get a different decomposition, and now you get something that can be either 0 or 4, and in this case, we know that it has to be 4. Okay. So the decomposition depends upon the hidden variable state, and if you don't choose the right one, you can get an incorrect bound. Okay. So, my conclusions. First of all, I believe the standard definition of contextuality is a little bit too broad, and prior measurements can affect later compatible measurements. That's not maybe obvious to some. I think that's reasonable. Cook and Specker theorem relies on this functional composition principle, which I've argued is unwarranted, and you can have probability measures that vary by context in a very natural deterministic way. Contextuality can be understood as a natural consequence of the measurement process and interactions and disturbance of the underlying ontic state. And recent experimental tests cannot rule out a hidden variable model that has this sort of measurement disturbance effect. There have been other tests beyond this, but I don't have time to go into those. But I don't see any issues there either. All right. Okay.
Minutes for questions?
Yes, David.
If the measurements are space-like separated, then the measurement disturbance is non-local.
Then it's non-local, yes.
And the Cauchy-Specker theorem is usually expressed these days not as a no-go theorem for hidden variables theories the way that Cauchy-Specker expressed it, but as a no-go theorem for non-contextual hidden variable theory.
Right.
So then I don't understand your criticism that says that the functional composition principle is unwarranted because we can have contextuality. It's warranted, I think, for a non-contextual hidden variable theory, isn't it?
Yeah, what I'm basically arguing is that that's an unreasonable restriction to maintain
an,
that
an unreasonable restriction on non-contextual hidden variable theories?
I'm sorry.
It's an unreasonable restriction on non-contextual hidden variable theories? Non-contextuality is an unreasonable restriction on hidden variable theories?
The restriction that is imposed by the functional composition principle is unreasonable, is physically unreasonable.
Okay. I mean, we know that we can have contextual hidden variable theories because we've got the Bohm theory.
Right.
And your last two points, we can have contextuality as a consequence of measurement disturbance. Well, we know that from the Bohm theory, and experimental tests can't rule out a hidden variable model with measurement disturbance. Well, we know that from the Bohm theory too.
Right. The point I'm trying to make here is that contextuality is the appearance of contextuality as a physical phenomenon is something that I wouldn't put into the camp of things that are characteristic of quantum weirdness.
So this is a comment on if you make a measurement A at one moment in time and then you decide to make B and C later, of course the outcome of A cannot depend on that.
Right.
So that is of course respected by the Broglie-Bohm theory. That's the first comment. So the Broglie-Bohm theory also have a different sort of contextuality. And that's if you have two commuting operators A and B, then the value you get for A depends on if you make the measurement of B before or after A. So this is a new type of contextuality. So it's very easy to derive just from that condition that A cannot depend on if you do B and C afterwards.
Right.
So I would also like to say that so one should also consider this type of contextuality because it's a new one.
Yes, I would agree, and I'm saying that that should be part of the broader notion of what contextuality is. But I'd also add in the caveat that's not a physically unreasonable thing to suppose. By the way, I want to make one comment to David's question regarding locality. Although space-like separated measurements will imply non-local interactions, in the experiments that were actually conducted, and all the experiments that I'm aware of that have been conducted, they were not tests of locality. They were all local time-like separated measurements.
Any other questions? Well, let's thank our speaker and all the speakers for today. Thank you.